Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas and my co-host, as always, is David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, folks. Hi, Perry.
How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty well, I think. I'm pretty well. Oh. It's a bit chilly here in Melbourne at the moment, but that's all right.
Well, at least we've hit winter rather than being stuck in summer forever.
Yeah, well, that's true. We'll be complaining about the summer when it comes.
We complain about the summer and we complain about the winter. And as Mark Twain said, everybody complains about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Okay, David, well, the major thing I want to talk about this week is a follow-on from the discussion we had about the Hugos episode or so back when I was talking about how the Dublin Convention, this year's Worldcon, had sent out the Hugo packet, which is copies of all of the shorter fiction and some of the longer fiction, that is novels, which they make available for all of the members of the convention so that it gets them an opportunity to have access to the actual Hugo-nominated works so they can read them prior to voting. Excellent idea. Fantastic stuff. Yep. A really, really good bonus for being a member of a Worldcon, even if you're not attending, even if you're just supporting. It's an excellent idea. So what I wanted to talk about was the fact that I've finished all of the short fiction. In fact, I have finished all of the novels as well.
That's remarkable.
So I've pounded my way through all this. Well, as I said a couple of weeks ago, the thing about it is that a lot of the shorter stuff this year was readily available online because a lot of the stuff had been nominated from a lot of online sources as opposed to the standard print stuff as it has been in the past, you know, basically Analog, Asimov's, that sort of stuff. These days, we're moving a lot more into the works being available there online so you can actually go and read them. So we've got four fiction categories and three shorter fiction. So we've got the novellas, the novelettes, and the short stories. As mentioned a couple of episodes ago, the novellas are, in essence, short novels, anywhere between, say, 60 pages and 150 as an approximation. So these days, we're getting six nominees in every category for various reasons, which we may come to at some point down the track, but probably not this week. But anyway, we're getting six nominees. And in the novellas, it's an interesting look to the novellas this year, David. Probably, if you're not keeping up with the field, there's probably a lot of people here, the authors, that you probably have never come across.
Absolutely. I haven't heard of most of them, I think.
Yeah, well, these...
Which is a shadow on me. I should try to keep up a bit better than I do, I think.
Okay, well, the first of the short fiction categories I want to cover is the novellas. Six works nominated, five by females and one by male. So that's a bit of a change from what has happened in the past, where the science fiction field in particular has been very badly criticised and heavily criticised and probably rightly criticised for being far too much interested in old white males, for want of a better phrase. These days we're getting a lot more diverse voices coming through, which is only for the better. It can only make the field a better place in which to publish and better works to be read.
Indeed.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about the Martha Wells and Nnedi Okorafor novellas. And there's also one other, C. Nan McGuire, Beneath the Sugar Sky, which is also a novella in a series that was referred to as Wayward Children. The first of these, a couple of years ago, won the Hugo and Nebula Awards, and it was really quite excellent. I don't think the Beneath the Sugar Sky is up to that level of the first one, so it's gone down the list for me. Kelly Robson's Gods, Monsters and the Lucky Peach is pretty good, but nah, not quite there for the way that I wanted to get things out of it. It's really worthwhile reading, but not there. The Tea Master and the Detective by Elliot de Bodard. She's a very interesting writer. Vietnamese-French background, so really good diverse background. She brings a lot of Asian viewpoints into her fiction. And The Tea Master and the Detective is part of a long-running series that she has of stories set in a part of the Milky Way that has been colonised by mainly Asian countries. And they follow a very much an Asian cultural background. So tea is very, very important to them all. The Tea Master and the Detective reads to me like the first in a series of detective novels. And this is a variant on the Sherlock Holmes style of having a detective and an offsider. The Tea Master, the human in this instance, is the detective, or no, in fact, actually, the detective is the detective, my apologies. And the Tea Master here, because it's the mine ship, a very large ship with run by an artificial intelligence, which acts as the Tea Master and acts as the Watson to the detective, if you like, in this instance. So it's quite an interesting novella, and hopefully she writes a fair number of more in it. And as I said, she just won the Nebula Award, but isn't up at my level, the level that I put it up in the top one or two or three. And the last one is by a gentleman called, and I'm certain I'm going to mispronounce his middle name, P. Dejelly Clark, The Black God's Drums. This is a alternate history novella set in New Orleans, and it has pirates, airships, hot air balloons, fantastic stuff.
What more could you ask for?
Really quite interesting, and I would hardly recommend it. But for me, my top three are basically Artificial Condition by Martha Wells. I spoke about this a week or so back. Then Binti, The Night Masquerade by Nnedi Okorafor, and then The Black God's Drums, P. Jelly Clark. They are the ones I'm going to be voting for. We'll just see how the rest of it goes.
Sounds good.
Yeah, then we move on to the Hugo-nominated novelettes. Again, we have a number of female writers here. In fact, the number of female writers in the short fiction and even in the novel level is completely turned it right around. If 30, 40 years ago you were to look at any of the Hugo categories, you would have seen that the bulk of the authors nominated were male, with maybe one or none female. Now it seems to be completely the other way around. So there's a big shift that's happened in the science fiction and fantasy fields over the last 10, 15 years or so. Most of the novelettes are, you know, just sort of so-so. There was only a couple that ended up on the final ballot that I had actually nominated. And really the one that I wanted to bring up was The Last Banquet of Temporal Confections by Tina Connolly, which was one that I read before the nominations were open, and it was one that I nominated, and it's one that I'm going to vote for. And it is a fantasy, which is not normal for what I do. I don't normally nominate fantasy works for the Hugo, but I was quite taken with this one and thought it was pretty good, so I put it on my nominating ballot. It's basically, the main character is a baker of temporal confections. The idea is that they have the skill of being able to distill an emotional experience into the pastry that they make. And so the king of this particular empire that she lives in has, of course, basically decided that this baker is going to be only work for them. And the baker's relatives have been tortured by this king. So it's a matter of finding your way through to get the perfect revenge, if you like. So The Last Banquet is quite apt in terms of the title. Quite an excellent little story, and I would hardly recommend that one. Now, the Hugo-nominated short stories. The one that I've actually come down to going for in terms of what I'm going to vote for, a month ago, I had third or fourth on my list. Oddly enough, I kept on coming back to it. Every now and again, something would pop up and I'd hear a bit about this one, and it actually won a Nebula Award. And that sort of sparked my interest again, and I started thinking about it. And I got to the point where I thought, I can't stop thinking about this particular story. And it is actually far better than I thought it was first off. It's got a fantastic title, The Secret Lives of the Nine Negro Teeth of George Washington, by P. Dejelli Clark, the one that we mentioned earlier on with the Black God's Drums in the novella category. So he's got two works nominated. The Secret Lives of the Nine Negro Teeth doesn't have much of a plot. And the nine Negro teeth of George Washington are those teeth that not from nine Negro slaves that are given to George Washington that he wears hooked together in a necklace. Now, I'm not saying that George Washington particularly did this in real life, but this is what's happened in the fantasy. And so the story tells the background of each of those nine Negro teeth. So it's told in four, in nine little snippets that all go together to make up a story. Quite an interesting piece. And as I said, it's one that's kept on coming back to me. And I've actually made the choice to change my vote, which I can do. The good thing about the voting mechanism these days is that you do it all online. You can go into the voting webpage, put your votes in, they get all stored. Later on, you can come back and change your votes if you so desire, and you can do whatever you like to them later on. And so that means that right up until the deadline, which I think is probably the end of this month, I could put them in, and then 2 weeks later I can come back going, yeah, I've changed my mind again and I'm going to do something else. Or I could just put them all in and there we are, they're done. I think that in the next couple of days I'm just going to put my votes in and be finished with them. But I could hardly recommend The Seven Lives of the Nine Negro Teeth of George Washington. As I said, a fantastic title and a very, very interesting short story.
Indeed, it sounds very interesting. Well, I really feel well behind the times in catching up with these authors, but on your recommendation, I'll have a look at them. The one about the Negro teeth interested me because it wouldn't have been all that unusual for white people to have dentures, which would have had Negro teeth in them, I imagine. I'm pretty sure that was one of the things that they did. Certainly, they made dentures out of other people's teeth, or they made them wooden dentures, didn't they? As yes. Well, but yeah, I think they also inserted other people's teeth in them, so that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, you know, this is the interesting thing about this one is that they are given to George Washington as basically souvenirs. Here's a tooth, and you know it's supposed to have magical powers or whatever. And the story tells the background of each of those teeth.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
I think there's some very good short stories here, and I think there's some not so good novelettes. And I think there's some excellent novellas. That seems to me to be the way that the lengths seem to go. I don't find as much interest in the novelette length as I do in the short stories and in the novellas, but in particular the novellas. I think that's really an excellent place for people to find out about a new author and before they maybe jump into some 6 or 8 volume, 5,000 page fantasy or science fiction epic, you can at least get to have a read of a 120-page novella and work out whether you actually like the style.
Remind me again about the lengths of these the categories. Is novella longer than novelette, or is it the other way?
Yeah, the short story is up to about 7,500 words. I haven't got the numbers in front of me, so forgive me, but it's around about 7,500 words. Novelette is about 7,500 up to about 15,000 words.
Yeah.
And novella is about 15,000 words up to about 45,000 or 50,000. And novel is above that. So it's a graduation in terms of the sizing. Not every prize within the science fiction field has exactly the same word count. So that's why you actually get to the point where one of the works nominated for a novelette category this year for the Hugos, The Only Harmless Great Thing by Brooke Bollander, which I think won the Nebula, is nominated in at least one other award. I'm not sure which one, but at least one other award at the novella length. So it fits right around about the boundary between the novelette and the novella. So it's around about 45 to 50 pages. So you get a little bit of crossover in terms of lengths, but at least with the Hugos, after all this time, they've actually got to the point where they have bedded it down and everybody seems to be pretty happy with the lengths that are there.
Okay, great.
Yep. So that's my my run-through of the short fiction Hugo nominees.
Well, I think you've pretty much covered the entire written fiction category, so that's great. You're listening to Two Chairs Talking, a podcast hosted by Perry Milmes and David Grigg. Now we'd like to introduce a new segment that we thought of, which is something we're going to be calling the Hugo Time Machine. And the idea is that we go back in time, if you like, and look at some previous years and the Hugos that were awarded in those years. And if we could might work our way through, maybe not every year, but certainly years where there's something particularly of particular interest to talk about. And so we go right back to 1953, which was the first year that the Hugos were awarded, the year they were invented, I suppose, and created. It might be interesting to find out some history about the background to that and why they decided to start giving awards. It was awarded by the World Science Fiction Convention. Now, in typical American fashion, as with the World Series of Baseball, they called their National Science Fiction Convention the World Science Fiction Convention, but it wasn't for many years before it started to go overseas. I think the first time it went overseas was to the UK. But in 1953, I can't remember now off the top of my head which city it was in. Never mind. But here's the Hugo Awards that were given then, the very first Hugo Awards. And then the very first novel Hugo was awarded to The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester. And I actually just finished rereading that to remind myself of it. But it's certainly a book that one would consider to be a classic of the field. And it stands up pretty well, unlike some science fiction from that era or a little before, like Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, which are a bit creaky and a bit hard to cope with in terms of how well they're written. The Demolished Man, I thought, stood up very well indeed. It starts with a concept of a society in which some people are telepathic. They call themselves peepers. They have this extrasensory perception, the ability to read people's minds. And there is a group of people in society, not everyone has this ability. And so the people who do have this ability form a sort of elite, and they become very rich. But there's also a society which controls their ethics and tries to keep them under control, I suppose. But it's a society of these people with this ability to mind read. So that's an interesting background. But then what Bester throws in is the idea of a man who wishes to commit a murder. And so the idea, the real issue here is, in a society where your mind can be read, how do you, one, plan a murder, and two, carry it out and get away with it without being detected by these people who can read minds? And so that's the concept, which is, I think, a pretty clever concept. And it starts with a character called Ben Reich, I think that's the right name, Ben Reich, who is a billionaire, if you like. He runs a conglomerate, which is in bitter competition with another conglomerate. And he decides that the only way to succeed is being beaten by this other group. The only way he can succeed is to kill the CEO of the other corporation. And so he goes about planning to do this, and it's a quite intricate method of how he's going to avoid the mind readers during this process. And then it becomes really almost like a Raymond Chandler type novel, a sort of hard-bitten detective story in which there's a conflict of minds between the murderer and the main detective, a guy called Lincoln Powell, who's trying to, he knows pretty quickly that Reich did this, but he has to be able to prove it to everyone's satisfaction and the satisfaction of the courts. And so there's a lot of byplay backwards and forwards as to trying to get the evidence to prove the case. And so it's a very satisfying book, and it holds the interest up right to the end. An interesting society with some interesting concepts to it, interesting consequences of the fact that lots of people can mind read. One of the quite fun things is which I'm not sure is to do with mind reading, but is the fact that people have introduced typographic characters into their names, so that someone called Atkins, for example, uses the little swirly at symbol that we're familiar with from email addresses. Someone called Wigand has the ampersand at the end for the and. It's a quite a clever thing. And someone called Quatermain has the 1/4 symbol at the start of their name. Well, that was quite a fun little thing, but it's very minor in the scheme of things. But it's just a clever, interesting society with some interesting implications and a very interesting plot, I thought, with some very deep psychological issues to it. It reminded me a little bit of Alfred Hitchcock's movie Spellbound, where you have unconscious motives going on that don't come to the surface until much later in the plot. So I really enjoyed rereading it, which is not something one can say for some of the classics of yesteryear, but I thought it was an interesting book. Have you read it, Perry? What do you think?
Yes, I reread it about 18 months ago, and I noticed that I looked this up just the other day, and I noticed that on that wonderful website, Goodreads, that you'd given it a 5-star. I gave it 3. I wasn't quite as enamored of it as you were. It strikes me as a novel that, and I do seem to recall reading this when I was around about 15, so that's about 50 years ago. And I reckon that I probably thought that this was a pretty damn good book at that stage. Now, not so much. I got the feeling that there were a lot of things that did not gel all that well for me. I thought some of the motivations, the movement from one particular point of view over to another, when he firstly decides that he's going to commit a murder until he persuades somebody else to help him, was done in such a short period of time. It just didn't hold true to me. So there's a few things with it that don't, I think, hold up over the period. I can understand why people think it's a fantastic book, and it would have been at the time, absolutely. But now, for me, not so much.
Yeah, that's fair. But enough.
It's just a matter of what you like and what you don't like, I think. And as I said, I think this is probably one of those books that I would have loved when I was 15, and not so much now.
See, I've obviously never grown up. That's the problem. But yeah, no, it's well worth saying that I think certainly in terms of the competition at the time, it probably was really a standout book, and because the competition wasn't all that great, let's face it.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that. See, this is the 1953 Hugo was given out at the PhilCon 2 at the Philadelphia WorldCon, and it was for novels published in the calendar year of 1952. And in 1952, Asimov had two books out, The Currents of Space and Foundation and Empire. And as you said earlier, the Foundation stuff doesn't really hold up all that well.
No, that is something to read at the age of 15.
Yeah. The other ones were A.E. Van Vogt's The Weapon Masters.
Yeah,
there's a Cyril Judd novel, which was C.M. Cornbluth and Judith Merrill. Mm-hmm. Gunnar Cade, never heard of it, know nothing about it. James Blish's Jack of Eagles, again, don't know that. Lester Del Rey's Marooned on Mars.
Yeah.
So there was Clark's Islands in the Sky.
Yeah, that's short stories, I think, isn't it?
What else? E.B. White's Charlotte's Web, but here we're getting into YA stuff.
Wow.
And also in the YA era, you've got Heinlein's Space Family Stone, otherwise known as the Rolling Stones.
Oh, that is a great book to read when you're 15. That's terrific, at 15.
Yep. Oh, and also I think, I have to be sure about this, but I'm not terribly sure, but I think... Cliff Simak's City was also published that year.
Okay, well, that would have been a contender.
Yeah, well, see, then I come back to this, and then I sort of say that it's probably, again, been 50-odd years since I read Simak's City, but I have fond memories of that. I don't have a lot of fond memories of the demolished man.
Oh, fair enough.
That's it.
Fair enough. All right.
Yep, and that's the way it goes.
Okay, then. Well, let's move on to the other categories that they gave out. There was a limited number of categories in that year. So the next one was for Best Magazine, Best Science Fiction Magazine, I believe. So I'm just basing this on the Hugo Award website. It looks like they gave a joint award to Astounding Science Fiction, edited by John W. Campbell, and Galaxy, edited by H.L. Gold.
Yeah, it was a tie that year.
A tie, yeah. I have very fond memories of Galaxy magazine. And the reason is that I was incredibly lucky at the age of about 16, I suppose. I had a good friend at school whose parents were very keen science fiction fans. And as you do, you got to get to talking about these things. And I talked to his parents about their interest in science fiction for a bit. Anyway, they got a job. His father was a teacher, and he got a job in Papua New Guinea, and they was going to be there for 5 or 6 years or something like that. And they didn't want to take all their books with them. And in particular, they had a huge collection of science fiction magazines. And I was enormously lucky in that they asked me if I would like to have the collection of science fiction magazines. Would I what?
Yes.
So the collection of Galaxy, which were mainly British reprint editions, so they weren't that valuable, but the collection of Galaxies went back to this sort of era, 1950, 1951, coming all the way through to about 1963 or 4, I think, which is a little bit before they went overseas to Papua New Guinea. And so I inherited this huge collection. It was science fiction. It was Galaxy magazine. It was fantasy and science fiction. There were a few Astoundings and Analogues, but it was mainly the Galaxies. And so I read an enormous amount of short fiction and serial fiction in those magazines. And so I have very fond memories of Galaxy. Did you read any of these magazines, Perry?
My father has been a science fiction reader for a long time. He's a 1930s boy, so he probably started reading science fiction in the early 40s. So he would have been reading, Astounding. So there was a lot of Astounding magazines around, and that's probably where I started picking things up. And around about the age of 10, 11, 12, there was a lot of Astounding, and that state it probably just about turned over to Analog, I think, in the mid late 60s. I can't remember exactly when it changed name. I'd have to look that one up. But I think a lot of them were Analog at about that stage. But Campbell was still editor, and he was through until the late 60s or early 70s. And my father had those around the place, so I read a lot of those. But that was the only one that he subscribed to. He certainly isn't a fantasy reader, so fantasy and science fiction, even though it might have published some fantastic science fiction, never entered the house because it had fantasy in the title.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was out. Yeah. And I don't think he ever picked up any Galaxies, or certainly not Worlds of If, because If would have been the fantasy equivalent of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I had a few of those. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a few old New Worlds from Britain.
Gosh, yeah, no.
Pottering around.
Yeah.
Don't think there was much else. I don't think he was a Weird Tales reader as well, because that would have been, again, more fantasy orientated. So his stuff was mainly along the Astounding science fiction. So I have no problem with Astounding having won the award in this particular year. Mm-hmm. And having looked back on it and bought a number of old Galaxies from the 50s and 60s, although mainly from the 60s when I got a bit older, they were a pretty good magazine as well.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I'm sort of a bit shocked that Astounding didn't win it outright, because Campbell's influence in the field was just so vast at that time. It was basically him and everybody else was second, and so you would have thought that there would have been... He would have picked up a lot more kudos because of that, a lot more votes, but hey, who knows?
There you go. Yeah, it was, I looked it up, it's 1960 when he changed from Astounding to Analog.
Oh, okay. I thought it was much later than that.
Yeah, so that's good. Well, according to Wikipedia, so we can...
Basically means that I was 5 in 1960, so if my father had things floating around in the house, then they would have all have been analogue that were coming in, and there would have been a number of old Astoundings floating around.
Yeah. It was originally called, according to Wikipedia, it was originally called Astounding Tales of Super Science. Yes, Astounding Stories of Super Science. So that that part of it dropped out pretty early, I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, probably not a bad idea either.
Yeah, indeed. So then going to the categories where you get to the artists and illustrators, people who did those lovely lurid covers of these science fiction magazines, Hannes Bock, whose work I don't particularly know, Ed Emshwiller, who I do know and think of very favourably, mainly for his black and white illustrations inside Galaxy. He illustrated Bester's books and a huge number of other stories, but he had a really nice black and white illustration style, I thought. And then I think Best Illustrator went to Virgil Finlay, who had a very interesting technique. He used a scratchboard with black ink covering it and scratched away the black to reveal the white. And he had this method of producing this very stippled look to his drawings, which must have been incredibly time-consuming. But he had a very, very unique style because of that. So that's interesting. He did do some he did some color work. He did a cover of Galaxy for The Ballad of Lost Camel by Cordwainer Smith. So that, which looks interesting. So, but he was certainly a well regarded illustrator and deserving of that. Then we had the other award was for excellence in fact articles, which went to a chap called Willy Ley, who was a German chap, who in the early days, growing up in Germany, was involved with the development of rocket societies, hobbyist societies interested in rocketry, of which, of course, Wernher von Braun was later a part. What Ley, however, as he grew towards adulthood, left Germany as the rise of the Nazis happened. In about 1935, I think, he came to England and then the United States. But even from early days in Germany, he'd been a science writer, someone who wrote about science. And he continued that in a very illustrious career in the United States. He wrote an article every month for Galaxy and published a number of books, writing about the scientific side of science fiction. And again, because he was in those Galaxy magazines I inherited, I do have a fondness for his work. Do you read any of his articles, Perry? They sound familiar?
Nothing much that sort of stands out, to be perfectly frank.
Yeah, but
he
was a good science writer. Whereas I think he would have been sort of the equivalent of an Isaac Asimov doing science writing. But he was, I thought he was very good. And then finally, we had Best New Author, which is a category which I think nowadays we would probably would be the same as the John W. Campbell Award, which is given to Best New Author in the field. And that year it went to someone called P.J. Farmer, Philip Jose Farmer, which is interesting, actually, because if you look at Farmer's career, all of his novels and his novel series and so on, were later than that. So it was obviously a new writer at the time. I looked at his list of short stories and he kind of had very many stories out by the time the award was given. So he did pretty well to be picked, I think, at that stage.
Okay, David, so that covers a lot of old Hugo stuff. And we also did some of the shorter stuff earlier on in this episode. Part of what I said earlier was that I had now finished reading all of the novels for the Hugos, and there's six of them. The last two that I've read just recently are Trail of Lightning by Rebecca Roanhorse and Revenant Gun by Yoon-Ha Lee. Trail of Lightning is a debut novel by Rebecca Roanhorse. She won a short Hugo award either last year or the year before for the Your Authentic Indian Experience. She's a First Nations member from North America. So the book that we're reading here, Trail of Lightning, is very much steeped with the Navajo mythology, as much as I'm aware of it. It's not an area that I've studied at all, so I can only go from the idea of what I've picked up in the particular novel. And it tells the The plot tells the story of a post-apocalyptic world set in the middle of North America on what would be the First Nations reservations, which are now blocked off. It seems that there has been a catastrophic environmental disaster where there's been a great flood and that the vast bulk of North America has been flooded and is now underwater. And because the First Nations reservations are way inland, they are actually not so closely affected by all of the difficulty that's been caused by the environmental disaster. But somewhere along the line, and though this isn't necessarily explained as to whether it's a plague or something else, but there are a number of monsters roaming the world in human form. And our main character is a woman who earns her living by being able to smell out and then seek out and destroy monsters, which she does for various people. But she's also been tasked by some of the elders in the First Nations to basically try and clean up the monsters, and also to end up fighting against some of the gods that have seemed to have manifested themselves on the face of the earth as well. So this is a strange amalgam of a post-apocalyptic fantasy world where it actually reminded me a little bit of the young adult trilogy of books written by the Australian author David Cornish, the Monster Blood Tattoo, which came out about 10, 12 years ago. I think his books were much more detailed and richer, but this is a pretty good nominee for the Hugos, and it's a pretty good debut. Worth reading. It's quite obviously the first in a series, which probably means it's going to be three books that we're going to have to get through. It should be okay. I read it. I thought it was quite good, and I got all the way through it and enjoyed it, though it isn't necessarily going to be my favourite. I'm not going to get my vote for this year. The other one that I read is a book by Yoon Ha Lee, which is the third in his Machineries of Empire series. And to be perfectly frank, I'm completely confused by this book. I just got lost. I have a problem with authors who they write a trilogy and it is really deeply complicated. They're published 1 year apart. And to be perfectly frank, I can remember, I've read the two previous books in this trilogy because both of them were nominated for major awards in the field. And I remember bits about the first one and I remember bits about the second one. But the deep nuance that I would have to be able to appreciate what's going on in this has been lost to me. Now, I don't have time to go back and read. Whenever a new book in a trilogy comes up, I don't have time to go back and reread 700 pages of background material so I can read this book and see if I can enjoy it. And I frankly didn't enjoy this one much at all. I got completely confused. There's a problem when you have books that are told over multiple timelines and then they jump between one and the other, and it seems like she's telling me this happened 8 years before, and then a couple of chapters later you're reading stuff and you think, hang on, isn't this in this batch which was 8 years ago? But there's nothing in the top of the chapter to tell you that it's the previous timeline. And I don't know, and it's the same character, but the same character is the same personality, but it's living in two, maybe three different bodies. Oh, God, it got confusing.
It sounds very confusing.
It just got the stage. I couldn't finish it.
No.
Unfortunately, it's the only one of the year that I just could not finish. I got the point where I thought, I am lost. And I've been trying to read it within about a week, and I just could not work out what was going on. I could understand that I actually liked the first book. I didn't quite understand it, but I got into it in the second half, and it seemed to sort of hold together pretty well. The second one, yeah, not so much, and this one, not at all. It just far too confusing for me, and so I was just a bit lost. So anyway, that finishes my list of novels for the Hugos. I think that I'm probably going to go for Spinning Silver by Naomi Novik. That's the one that I've chosen. There were some problems with that as well, but you can only choose what's you think is the best of the ones that are there in front of you. And that's what I think is happening here. So that's what I've gone for. And I'm going to go for Naomi Novik's book.
Yeah. All right. Very good.
So what about you, David? What have you been up to? What have you been reading?
I thought one thing I might comment on in what you just said about the problem of catching up with a trilogy, having to reread the previous books to figure out where you're at. One of the books I have been reading progressively is I've been reading my way through the Expanse series, and I got in, I think, with book three, and so that was fine. I sort of read books one, two, three in one run, but then each year there's another volume comes out, and I think we're now up to book eight. We are up to book eight.
Yep.
And the problem is that book eight came out, and I'm thinking, oh God, I've forgotten what happened in book seven. Yeah. And I try to skim back, and I'm thinking I really don't want to start back at book one and have to read all my way through to get to book eight.
You've actually got a bit of a bonus with this one in that you can actually go and watch the TV series, which we will talk about at some point because it is bloody good.
Yeah, I know it is good. Yeah, that's an issue. But anyway, there's a final book coming out in the Expanse series, so I'll wait, I think, until that comes out, and then maybe I'll go back to the start and reread the whole damn lot to get all the way through. But I haven't done that yet.
As an aside, I can tell you that I can remember about 5 or 6 years ago, I decided one year that I was going to buy my father I buy him novels that I think he might be interested in for his birthday and for Christmas. He doesn't really want anything else. He enjoys reading those. And I said to him, look, I found a new space opera series that I thought he might be interested in. He said, well, nobody writes space opera anymore. And I said, no.
Yes, they do.
They actually do. And this is pretty damn good. And he said, oh, yeah, okay. So I bought it for him, read it. He read it. I bought it for him, landed it in his post office box. He picks it up. I would reckon that the next time that I spoke to him, which was within a week, he said, it's fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And so that was enough so that he had another 6 months and the next book came out, so I bought him that. And after he'd read about three or four, he actually rang me up and said, this is the best science fiction series I have ever read. And so he thinks the Expanse is absolutely fantastic. And he goes back and reads them from number one all the way right through whenever there's a new one that comes out. So he's on top of it. He knows exactly what's going on every time. So he's probably read the first one about six times now.
Wow, no, I couldn't do that. But I think that's what I will do. I'll wait for number nine to come out and then I'll reread the whole lot from the start.
I think that's probably worthwhile going back and doing for this one.
Sure. Now, other than that, I've been reading some Australian classics.
Oh, good.
Why, you say? Partly for interest, of course, but I thought I might mention the fact that I'm involved with a project called the Standard Ebooks Project. And the idea of that is to take books which are in the public domain. Mostly the transcriptions have been done by organizations like Project Gutenberg. But the format of those books, when they finish with them, is very varied. It can be very sloppily done. There can be a lot of problems in the way they're put together, the way the table of contents works, a whole series of issues you might have with those. So the idea is that we take those transcriptions and clean them up, proofread them carefully, apply a standard format to them, and make them available for free. Free and open source. And by open source, I mean that you can actually go on to a site called GitHub and you can look at the books, the source code of the books there, download that, make your own changes and submit them and request that those changes be included. And the people who run the project can look at your changes and say, oh, yes, that's right. He's picked up a spelling mistake there or this problem here and fix it. So it's a continuing, ongoing project. Then these books are open source. So there's about 250 titles out now. You can look and find them at standardebooks.org, standardebooks, all one word, .org. And they're all free. And we try to find nice covers for them. So they all look good. So sort of high quality books. Anyway.
Yeah, you're doing a good job with those, and I think that's fantastic. Tell me, what's the? And I know that you have problems because I was I was having a look at the work that you did on the mystery of the hansom cab, and there's a note in there about you have taken the standard ebooks takes as much care as it can to determine the copyright of the works. But copyright has now sort of drifted a little bit, hasn't it? It's not quite the same in Australia as it is in the UK or is in the US.
Yes, the US have got the strangest policy. In Australia, we have, a pretty clear policy, and that's that 70 years after the death of the creator, it's in the public domain. It used to be 50 years, but we got pressured by the US to make it 70 years, which we did.
This is the Mickey Mouse rule, isn't it, for Disney, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, but they passed this law in America, as you say, basically to cover the early versions of Mickey Mouse. And the current rule is that something has to have been published prior to 1924. And in the case of written work, that's relatively easy to determine. But if it's a visual work, a piece of a painting, for example, or a painting we might want to use as a cover for one of those books, you have to be able to show that painting appeared somewhere in print prior to 1924, it is now. And that can be really, really hard or impossible in many cases. And so it can be very frustrating. You sort of pick a really nice looking painting which really illustrates the work well, and then you try and find the public domain proof of that, and it can be very hard to do. But it's when you succeed, it's very satisfying to have done that.
Okay, good.
Anyways, to go back, as you mentioned, I've been trying to do some Australian titles, which started with The Mystery of a Hansom Cab, which is actually by a New Zealand author, but he published it in Australia and about Melbourne, Australia. And I also have published for them Miles Franklin's My Brilliant Career.
Yep, good
book. Yep, and I've just a month or so ago finished Such Is Life by Joseph Furphy, which I'd never read before. I hadn't actually read any of these books before, prior to doing them for standard ebooks.
Oh, well, it's helping your education here,
well,
David,
that's
obviously.
Right. It's helping my education, yeah. But Such Is Life, I found a very enjoyable book. It purports to be a series of diary entries from someone called Tom Collins, but the actual author is Joseph Furphy, but under the pseudonym of Tom Collins. So it purports to be his diary entries, and it's not very clear, but he's supposed to be some kind of minor government official who travels around Australia. I'm never quite clear what his job actually is, but he spends all his time wandering around with his horses and talking to the people he meets on the road, and they can be the drivers of teams of bullock teams hauling huge amounts of wool and grain across Australia on the rural roads. Could be the squatters themselves, the owners of the vast properties that they put sheep on and so on, or just swagmen he meets by the side of the road, and a whole lot of other people. So it's really quite entertaining. He tries at some stages to reproduce the dialect of the people he meets, and which he tries to do this phonetically, and you end up with some results which are quite difficult to kind of figure out what's actually being said. Still, they're only short passages, and it's quite otherwise than that. It's very enjoyable. There's one lovely episode where he manages to lose his clothes. He's trying to cross a river, and to keep the clothes dry, he bundles them up on top of his head and swims with the bundle above the water. At which point, his dog leaps across, not wanting to get the dog's feet wet, and lands on the bundle of clothes and knocks them off Tom Collins' head, and the clothes go down river and he never sees them again. So here he is, essentially stark naked, on the wrong side of the river from where his camp is. I think he gets swept downstream for a while, so he can't simply just cross the river back to where his camp was and get some other clothes. And so this is quite an entertaining episode where he wanders around trying not to scandalize too many people, tries to steal pairs of trousers off clotheslines and doesn't succeed in that. And that's a very entertaining little episode. But there's also some very melancholy episodes in where there's one chapter where he talks about children lost in the bush And so that's quite a sad part of the story. But I enjoyed it a lot. It was quite fun to produce and to read through. So that was fun. Non-science fiction, of course. We're now talking Australian classics. And what else have I read? From Perry's recommendation, I read An Unkindness of Ghosts by Rivers Solomon, which I see was the nominee for the 2018 John W. Campbell Award for Best New Author. She didn't win, I don't believe. An Unkindness of Ghosts was a very interesting book, very good book, as you mentioned in our episode about a couple of episodes ago. It's a generation ship, but it's a generation ship which is split into many different layers, many different layers of society. And it's pretty clear that there's a reproduction, really, of the South in the days of slavery, because the people on the lower decks have coloured skin. They're treated very badly by the people on the upper decks. And the real interest in the book, I think, is the characters, really interesting characters. The main character is someone called Aster, A-S-T-E-R. Would you pronounce it Aster? Aster?
Yeah, that's what I like.
Something like that, yeah. She's had surgery to, I think she had a hysterectomy, and she's had a mastectomy, double mastectomy. So she's kind of an androgynous character. That was by her choice. And this is an interesting story. She's truly following up on the story of her mother, who apparently committed suicide, according to what Aster knows, when Aster was a child. But it becomes clear that that's not quite the case, and that she's left notes which are kind of encoded, which have been telling the story of what Aster's mother discovered about the ship and some of the secrets of the ship. So that's all very interesting. And the characters that Aster comes in contact with, her friend Genevieve and the surgeon of the ship, someone called Theo Smith, I think. And the all the interactions between these characters and trying to cope with the fact that the person who is in charge of the ship has changed. The original captain has died, and someone else is taking his place who's very much a demagogue, or someone who is going to be even stricter on the lower ranks, cuts down their food rations, that sort of thing. They cut down the heating for the people on the lower decks. So that was all a very interesting book. It was a bit disappointing at the end, I thought.
Yeah, I thought
kind of,
yeah, I agree.
A bit predictable, yeah. And a bit confusing rushed. As to actually what actually happens. But it's a book which is well worth reading, but a little bit disappointing at the end.
Yeah, I think it just ran to its conclusion a little bit too quickly.
Yeah, I think that's a good take. What else? I saw a movie. I don't often see movies.
Okay.
I saw Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, okay.
Which is an animated movie.
Yeah, my son loves this film. Absolutely thinks it's fantastic.
And yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, it's up on the Hugo ballot for Best Dramatic Presentation Long Form Movie, in other words.
I really don't think it deserves that, but it was a lot of fun. I mean, if you grew up like I did, getting hooked on Spider-Man in your early teens, which is pretty predictable, really. If you read a lot of comic books, then here comes this comic book character who's a nerd, who wears glasses, is studious, and suddenly he's bitten by a radioactive spider and turns into the superhero with superpowers and super strength. You know, what nerdy young man wearing glasses wouldn't pick up on that as being a wonderful role model? So I loved Spider-Man when I was young. And I've followed through on that interest. But Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is quite fun because it plays with the whole concept of parallel universes, different timelines. And so we have a young character, Miles Morales, who's mixed race, African-American, Hispanic, who is also bitten by a radioactive spider. But the Spider-Man of his timeline is killed by one of the villains. And young Miles Morales is really put in a position where he has to try and do something heroic of his own. There's been an experiment by the villain Kingpin, who breaches the walls between the parallel timelines. He's actually in search of his wife and child who died. He's trying to find another version of them. But he breaches the walls between the different alternate realities, and Spider-Man or Spider-Woman or Spider-Pig, spider characters from other parallel universes come into Miles Morales' universe and help him out. So look, it's not a deep and serious movie, but it was a lot of fun. So yeah, I enjoyed that.
Okay. Wife and I went on to the pictures, the flicks, to go and see the new Kenneth Branagh film, All Is True. So it's got Branagh and Judi Dench in the lead roles. Tells the story of the last few years of Shakespeare's life after the Globe Theatre is burnt down and he returns home to Stratford-upon-Avon and doesn't write anymore because he says that he's basically been written out. He's got nothing left to say. And I think the Globe Theatre burning down just basically did him in. And so it's just basically the story of the last few years of his life. Very well told, very well made. A few modern touches. My wife said she thought that Judi Dench was probably a bit too old for the role, but then somebody else that we went with said, yeah, but if Judi Dench says she wants to play a part, who's going to say no? And that's pretty much right. Look, it's certainly worth having a look at. It is very different from your big banner, Marvel and superhero stuff. It's quiet, slowish, well-made, brilliantly made, with a script by Ben Elton, one of the young ones, by of all people, but pretty damn good, and I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Okay, David, well, thanks very much. I think we've basically come to the end of our time. We've probably gone well over an hour, which is much, much longer than we thought we were going to, and especially considering that this wasn't really the episode we thought we were going to have this week. We had an interview lined up with somebody that fell through illness. Hopefully he is going to be feeling better sometime in the future, and we'll catch up with him in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, David and I will be discussing the first AussieCon, the first Australian Worldcon, held in August 1975, with the chairman of that convention, Robin Johnson, who will be in town this week, and we'll be having a chat with him. That interview will be coming up sometime in the future. There's a couple of other things we want to add to that, rather than just have it sitting out there on its own. But other than that, I think we'll be back in a couple of weeks to talk about whatever else we've been reading or watching or doing and whatever else we've been up to. So thanks very much, David, and we will see everybody in a couple of weeks. You've been listening to Two Chairs Talking. Thank you. Goodbye.
If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please go to the iTunes store and give us a rating. Nice one, we hope. Every good rating and review helps us attract new listeners. Thanks for that.